Hello and welcome. My guest today is Kevin Espiritu. Kevin is the creator of Epic Gardening, and he's amassed a following of over 3.6 million followers on social media, 11 million podcast downloads, and 42 million blog visits. Additionally, Kevin has authored two books, Field Guide to Urban Gardening, How to Grow Plants No Matter Where You Live, and Grow Bag Gardening, the revolutionary way to grow bountiful vegetables, herbs, fruits, and flowers in lightweight, eco-friendly fabric pots. Kevin is a gardening expert, and in this conversation, we spoke about what it's like to hang out with Carrie Underwood and Kehlani, the core skills that allowed him to start building massive businesses, why he doesn't have the suffer gene, what most young and new creators get wrong, and the problems with young male entrepreneurship. The reason why Kevin is such a great person to talk to is he's super self-aware, and he's really built a huge business for himself in the past 6 years since he's been doing Epic Gardening. This conversation is brought to you by the launch of my new course, Connect 1 plus 1 equals 3. If you're curious about how I get in contact with people like Andy Frisella, who's coming on the podcast pretty soon, Gary Vaynerchuk, Tom Bilyeu, Sahil Bloom, Chris Williamson, Dickie Bush, the names go on and on. There's so many incredible humans who have joined me. And if you're curious about how I got in contact with these people, check out Connect 1 plus 1 equals 3. Pre-order it now. It will only be available for pre-order for the special price of $100 for the next until Monday when the course actually goes live on March 6th. So get it now. If you're listening to this before March 6th, you can buy this course and you could sign up in the link down in the description. This podcast can also be sponsored by potentially you. If you want to reach creators, entrepreneurs, and some of the smartest people in the world, then go ahead and send me an email, danny@dannymiranda.com, or send me a message on Twitter. Those are the best places to get in contact with me for sponsoring this podcast. One ask of you, that is to share the show. I'm absolutely loving the quotes that I'm seeing on social media about people's favorite parts in the episode. And so if you want to do that on Twitter, if you want to do that on Instagram, I'll do my best to go ahead and share it as well. And continue sharing it in private, in group chats, in texts, in Facebook messages or DMs. Like, it all goes a long way in actually helping grow the show. So please share the show. It helps it grow. And if it grows, I'll be very happy. And now let's get into the episode with Kevin. Kevin, thank you for joining me today. Really appreciate you coming on. And I'm super excited to dive into you, your story, and just have a great time today.
Yeah, me too, Danny. I've been seeing you everywhere, so I'm glad to be on the show.
Well, I hope that's a good thing. But yeah. I'd love to start with Carrie Underwood. You're in my feed with Carrie. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, this is wild. YouTube star to now seeing her. Like, what is that like? How'd that come about?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. So we had done a collaboration a couple years back with Kehlani, who's an R&B singer. And that also kind of came about sort of randomly. I guess during the pandemic, she had a TikTok and she followed like 12 people. We were one of them, or I guess I was one of them back in the day, didn't have much of a team. And she just sent me a DM. Was like, hey, I need some help with the garden. And I was like, okay, well, I'll come up and check it out, and brought one of my team members. And then, the Carrie collab kind of came about the same way. Someone who was a big Carrie fan had mentioned that she had started following the account. And so then, she had posted something about tomatoes. I said, those are some big tomatoes, because they were. She's quite a good gardener. And we started chatting from there. She wanted some help setting up her greenhouse. I was going to be in Nashville, which is where she lives, just outside of Nashville. So I was like, hey, look, I'll come around and take a look at it, and kind of evolve from there. Obviously, we were like, well, this would be a great content piece to do, and a cool sort of mixing of the worlds of a YouTuber and, a true global superstar. So it was fun.
What's so interesting is that YouTubers really are true global superstars, but mm-hmm. we often don't have that in our head as what we imagine them to be, which is fascinating because in the truest sense, like YouTube is watched worldwide and it's mm-hmm. seen worldwide and you are truly known by millions of people, but you don't think of yourself, or I don't think of you that way, but your reach is insane.
Yeah, it's what. So what I've noticed is that you're right. Maybe the reach, especially, so there's like, I don't know, some, say like Madonna or something, like a legacy celebrity where she still has world recognition with her name, but her presence is not seen very much these days because she's just been out for a while. So everyone in the world sort of knows who Madonna is in a more superficial sense of they know Madonna. Maybe they haven't connected with her that much in life. And then the YouTube world, what I've noticed is, number one, you're not really seen as a superstar when someone meets you. Like if someone runs into me and they do recognize us from our videos, they don't think, at least from what I can tell, of me as some sort of, you know, vaulted figure like they would a Carrie Underwood or a Madonna or some of these like true superstars. So to me, there's still a big difference in like classic celebrity and YouTube celebrity. Although the effect, at least in my opinion, of YouTube is that you reach people on a much deeper level than some, at least, of these more classic folks.
Yeah, from doing research from this, I understood that you weren't trying to seek fame. You just want to help people and hope that people take something that you learned or you gave them and they can implement it in their own life. And when you come at it from that angle, it creates a way different relationship with the person who's listening or watching or viewing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I've always wondered about this because there are some like really famous YouTubers, let's say, that have catapulted their way into, call it classic celebrity or classic fame. And what I've noticed is those folks tend to be more the artist type of personality, where they're seen as sort of creative genius or otherworldly in some way, like almost magical. So, you know, like you know, rappers that have come out or musicians or like someone like a Joji who used to be Filthy Frank on YouTube and is now like a super famous musician. I feel like they're seen in a little bit different way. But someone like myself, you know, just a dude who loves growing potatoes, you know, and I helped you grow potatoes. So you come up to me and you say like, hey, thanks for helping me grow potatoes. You know, there's nothing too crazy about it.
Where would you put yourself on a scale of 100 where 0 is fully creative and 100 is fully business? Where along that spectrum would you place yourself?
I've wondered that for, I think, a while now. I think as a kid, I was very science focused, very science and math focused, but also grew up playing like piano and guitar and drawing a lot and stuff. So it may be a cop-out answer. I sort of feel like I wouldn't put myself on the spectrum and I would view them as complementary to one another. Because like even the act of business, the way you, especially with this whole creator world that we're in, like the way you express the business is an act of creation, right? Or like growing in the garden, it's like, well, you could build a pure aesthetic garden, you could build a pure production farm. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm somewhere in the middle, certainly, but probably skew a little bit more towards the business side, I guess.
When did you like realize you had an itch for business?
Oh man, that would have been early on, I think. I think as a kid, I was one of those classic, like, I don't know if I had the lemonade stand, but I certainly was like hustling those magazines, like door to door, that little program that you would do in elementary school, or back when Napster first came out, which would have been in sixth grade for me, I would take requests, like 10 song requests, and then I would download them and then burn the CD and then come back the next day and I'd say like, hey, it's $10 for your own mixtape, basically. And so, you know, probably not legal, definitely not legal, but you know, I was in sixth grade, I was a minor, whatever. I got a little taste of entrepreneurship back then.
And were there any other moments or attributes that you were like, all right, I can chase back and look back at what I'm doing now to those moments?
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that really was the triggering point was going to college. I went to University of California, Santa Barbara, and came in undeclared, came out with a business economics accounting degree, but actually had played online poker most of college and sort of paid my way through school that way, or at least made quite a bit of income that way. And so I was like staring down the barrel of this 80-hour a week accounting job at one of the big four firms. And I was like, yeah, I'm making more now than I would doing that. And so I certainly don't want to do that job. So at least that was like a fork in the road where I started walking down the path of something alternative. But it took a while before I even knew, you know, where I wanted to go after that.
Yeah. Well, what's so cool about diving into your story is that you have the poker background. You were like, kind of like, I'm not going to work for anyone. And then you were like, well, actually, like, that wasn't that smart of me. I'm going to be the second employee at Book in a Box, I think it was called, but now it's Scribe Media. And and then it's like, all right, I learned the business skills, and then I'm going to start my own thing. I think a lot of times, especially when I first graduated, I had this mindset of like, I'm never working for anyone. I'm building my own thing. Like, I'm not going to do that. And then it's like, as you get older, you see like a more nuanced perspective. What was that journey like for you?
Yeah, dude, it was really, it's almost a little cringe back then, because I came out of college and, you know, I definitely had a bit of an outlier sort of outcome having played poker to pay for a four-year degree at a decent school, right? So I kind of was like, oh, I've figured out some secret that no one else knows. Like, all my friends are working as accountants, sleeping under their desks, like literally during the busy season. Look at me. And then, you know, tried to do some business projects like website design, you know, local marketing for a lawyer or a dentist, and was like, okay, cool, I'm getting a little bit of success here, but it really was never enough to do anything but just kind of tread water. Mm. I wasn't drawing my savings down, I wasn't stacking cash, I wasn't like really thriving, but still somehow thought I was some kind of baller, you know? I was like, oh, I had this sort of, I guess just sort of some ego about that I had this alternative path, right? And I had figured something out. But the truth is, if I look back, you know, I would have been much better off, maybe not working the accounting job, but like finding some, you know, cool startup or some sort of person I could mentor under and just completely devoting myself to that and sucking up as much as I could. I'd be way further along in my career path or business life if I had done that. But I guess I was too proud or stupid to make that realization back then.
100%. How do you recommend people who are in that position to go about finding the person or the people to mentor under? Tucker Max is an incredible mind and an incredible writer. And you being the number two at that company is like, that's a sign that you knew the right person or the right people that you were going to learn from. Because I think that's an important piece of the pie.
I think a lot of this, it might not be the answer someone wants to hear, but a lot of this is just luck surface area and your ability to just have enough options on the table at any point in time. So for example, if we think about working at Book in a Box, which is now Scribe Media, and if someone doesn't know what they are, they're basically an alternative publishing company. They've done David Goggins' book, Can't Hurt Me, and his next one. So they have a few New York Times bestsellers under their belt now. And, you know, Tucker and my friend Zach co-founded that. And so the only reason I got that job, because I probably gave one of the worst interviews of certainly of my life, because I've only given a few, but I was talking with Tucker even just a few months ago, and he was like, that interview was one of the worst ones I've ever had. And Zach just said, dude, just give this guy a chance. Like, we're not hiring him because he's good at interviewing. We're hiring him because, you know, at the time I was doing some marketing, which I thought even that was a little nugget of wisdom, right? Like, you could be bad at interviewing, but good at the job you're trying to get. So that was kind of, I got lucky there. But yeah, it was just the fact that I knew Zach at the time. And the only reason I knew Zach is because I knew these other three guys who I knew from doing some random project and trying some stupid stuff out, right? And so it's just sort of like almost like a positive butterfly effect kind of thing mixed with the intuition to say, this is a good opportunity.
What was so bad about the interview in particular?
So Tucker's an interesting guy. He has a strong personality. He's very direct, and I just wasn't used to that, I guess. And so when we did the interview, he didn't seem too into it. I think right off the gate, he just didn't seem like he was sold on me, which I would have been sold on me in his spot. So there's no shame in that. But he asked me, he said, dude, what do you even want to do with your life? Like, what do you want to do? And I was like, okay, what is this question? You know, this is not. And so I don't even know what I said, but I think I said, look, like I seem to only be able to get to a certain level on my own. And Book in a Box seems like it's going really well only a few months in. I want to learn. Like, I just want to figure out, like, what am I not getting about this whole business thing? And then eventually I want to figure out how to do something for myself. And so an honest answer, basically signaling I wasn't going to be there for forever. And I guess maybe that helped, but maybe Zach just sold me a little hard. I'm not sure.
And then what were the lessons that you took away from that experience? I think it was 3 years.
Yeah, it was actually a little bit less. It was about a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
So we went from, I was the second employee, so there was four of us at the time. And when there's four of you and you're like 4 months into the business, we're writing the culture doc, which Tucker and Zach put together. It's still public on Scribe Media's website. You know, we all wrote that together. You know, we came up with the slogan for the company, Unlocking the World's Wisdom, which was, I think it's still the slogan today. And so you're learning a lot of the foundational aspects of company building. But I think the thing I learned the most, specifically from Tucker and Zach, they're just such independent thinkers. They're thinking from first principles. They're just sort of taking in info and spitting it out without, at least to me, it seemed like a lot of sort of knowledge from others, right? Or like regurgitation of things that other people have said. And so the thing I think I learned the most at Book in a Box was simply how to actually think for myself, which coming out the other end of that, if you actually gain that skill set, it's almost like the primordial skill set of being able to build something, right? If you can truly think for yourself, then the sky's the limit, it seems like.
Yeah, and I can't help but notice that there's a basis of writing in that whole process. Like in order to think clearly, you're writing, and the foundations that you've built your career on has been writing. So what do you think, why are writers such clear thinkers, and why is writing such a foundational skill for so many of the people that I'm covering on this podcast?
Yeah, you know, I suppose it's because you have to be. It's difficult to write a rambling sentence like maybe I'm speaking right now on the podcast. You have to write in a very clear way, and it has to be readable and legible by others. And I think it's kind of one of those things, like when I used to draw like the human anatomy and like skeletal structures and stuff, and I'd be drawing it, and then I'd say like, wow, dude, this like tibia looks amazing, you know, I'm such a pro. And then I'd go to sleep and I'd wake up in the morning to work on it again, and I'd look at it and I'd say, actually, it's not, like, it's flawed in this area. So to me, it was kind of the same with the writing stuff. Is you wake up the next day and look at it, and the thing you thought was amazing in the light of day, you see the flaws in, and so you continually refine it. And if it's writing about building the company or strategy or whatever, by nature of refining the writing, you're refining the strategy, right? So to me, I guess that's what it is.
Yeah. And on that point, I stumbled across your Medium blog in 2016, and you talked
some OG, yeah, OG shit right there.
It was great. It was great. But it was very clear writing about mental models. And one of the things you mentioned is you going to Toastmasters/improv comedy. And it was cool because you have that writing piece, and now you're stacking on top of it the ability to communicate yourself. It's like you're slowly building skills without even, it seems like, realizing or trying to do it. It was just like following your own curiosity.
Yeah, dude. I think the thing, there's a lot of folks that obviously, you know, now that we're big on YouTube and I've created for a lot of different types of media, some people want to know, like, okay, well, how do you get better at it? Or I hate the way I look. I hate the way I sound. I can't speak. It feels awkward. And if I could prescribe one dose to anyone for that, I would say just commit to doing a year of improv classes. And almost all of that will go away if you commit to it. Why? Because, dude, I've done a ton of sketches on stage to total strangers or in front of people who I don't really want to mess up in front of, like a date or a family member or something. And whatever happens on the improv stage is what happens, right? The whole principle of yes and, if someone makes a choice for you, you're not going to be like, actually, no, I'm not that, right? And so I've done sketches where I was like a talking can of beans or something like that. It's just something totally stupid. And so my philosophy, at least, is like, if I can confidently sell that, then certainly I could talk about something I know in the comfort of my own home confidently, right? Like, that's got to be easier. And so to me, that was huge. Toastmasters was also huge because that's like very structured public speaking coaching to the point where you'll go up, give a speech, and then the person who goes up afterwards is giving a speech about your speech. And they'll say, you know, Kevin, I really liked how, or let's say it's you, right? They'll say like, Danny, I really liked your confidence, your tonality was good. Your eye contact, actually, you kept looking at the floor though. And they'll say, I counted 7 ums, or they'll say, you know, you say right at the end of sentences, And it actually sort of is like looking for validation when you should just be confident in what you say. Don't keep saying right at the end, whatever it is, right? Everyone has their own sort of verbal tick. And then who's giving you that feedback, right? No one's giving you that feedback in your day-to-day life. And so you go, oh, shoot, like I actually do that. And you correct it and you become a much more clear speaker.
It's wild how much we communicate just by the way we say certain things.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-blowing. And the silence we use and our own internal dialogue. And you notice this. I listen to so many podcasts and I'm constantly amazed by how I'm noticing things about how people speak, how I speak. How I'm like, wish I could not say it like this and instead say it like that. And you only realize that from doing the reps.
It's like a small tell, right? Something that I've thought about a lot is in a text conversation. Let's say you're texting someone, maybe you're going to go out on a date with them or it's a friend. You can sort of tell who's subordinating themselves to the other because someone eventually will say a sentence and end it in LOL or haha. And the person who does that is sort of, they're sort of like deprecating the thing they just said, right? Like, I'd love to go out sometime, ha ha. It's like, that's not funny though. So why say the ha ha, right? And so it, much like in texting or in text conversations, it's kind of the same in speaking is if you always upward inflect at the end, or if you always say, you know what I mean? You're sort of like seeking something and you're not fully confident what you're saying. Thus, you can imply what that person's thinking in like their internal psychology.
You have so much self-awareness. That's what I realized from listening to you on so many podcasts and research for this. And I was curious at what point you felt like you understood yourself much better than at another point, or were you just born with the self-awareness?
Well, I think I've always been a thinker and that was harmful for a lot of life because you go into rumination mode and it just kind of goes nowhere. I would say there was sort of two formative events. One is my dad passed away accidentally when I was 12. And so that sort of left me with like a identity level or like a universal level. Hey, that wasn't supposed to happen. So what else isn't true about how I think the world is, right? So that to me was a big one. I call that like phase one, where I was one person. After that happened, I was a different person or just a different version of myself. And you can't really go back. So that was one big one. The other one was in my early 20s. I don't really remember what I was reading, but it was maybe some mix of Eckhart Tolle, these sorts of books on identity and ego and the present moment. And it was just the realization that there isn't actually a consistent identity that persists over time for oneself. There is in the sense that your brain will concoct the narrative and it will concoct sort of some semblance of stability. But when I really actually realized it, I was like, oh my God. So the things I think I am, I'm not, because I guess technically I'm not anything. So if I'm not anything, I could be anything so that I can unlock my gate to changing myself in any way I guess I wanted to. And I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's sort of what I realized. But it was weird because I realized it in a day on, I think, a Thursday when I was like 23. And I was consuming these books, et cetera. And so from Thursday to like Sunday, I slept 12 hours a day. And I had not worked out. I wasn't like abnormally tired or anything. I've never even talked about this. I don't even know if it makes sense. But what it feels like to me is my brain just like didn't get what was going on. It was like some crazy new realization and it like couldn't handle it and needed to sleep more to recover. I have no idea. It was the weirdest thing ever.
What happened? Like what happened after the fact? After you sleep 12 hours a day for 3 days, 4 days, what's the next week like? What's the next month like?
It wasn't that different except for that once I saw that truth, I couldn't unsee the truth, right? So once I realized, oh, there isn't actually the Kevin I thought I was from 0 to 12 and 12 to 23, I guess I was really neither of those. I'm just a experience machine that thinks it has a name that's running around and doing stuff. So it was, I guess, some level of freedom, some pulling back of the curtain of, I don't know, the nature of being alive. I'm not sure. I'm sounding too like enlightened. I'm certainly not that, but that's what it feels like. So
no, dude, I'm so happy you shared that. And it makes me ask or think about like how much of this is a choice, right? Like, I'm curious your perspective on it as a deep thinker and somebody who spent a lot of time. Like, I don't feel like I chose to create this podcast in some way, because I feel like it just came to be. You didn't choose for your father to pass away at 12. It just happened. Do you think we chose to be in this lifetime? I know you're very like a rational thinker, but like, what is your perspective on all this?
I guess you get into the whole free will determinism arguments, which I'm not really that versed in. And if I think about it too much, it actually makes me feel bad. Because if you go down the full sort of determinism path, you go, well, it's all programmed in a way. You know, what color are you going to think of next? Green. And if you say no, I'm actually going to think of red, well, then you're the type of person who thinks that way, right? So you can't escape that mental path. So I think the quote that I liked, and I'm not going to get it right, but it's like a Sam Harris type of thing where he's like, you know, determinism is sort of the way it is, but it doesn't really matter. Maybe that's the truth. Maybe we do have free will and it's somehow connected out to some force outside of this cosmic system. I don't even know, man. But what I do know is a lot of the people who are on podcasts in general talking about their life tend to really feel that they've done it all themselves, or that it's fully self-determined. They're a self-made man or woman, right? I just don't think that's true to the degree that I think most people do.
So what do you think is, like, do you think we have choices in this reality, or?
I think that I do, but I don't know if that means that I actually do, if that makes sense. And I think the fact that I think I do is all that really matters. You know, it's kind of like Cypher with the steak in The Matrix. He's like, I know this is fake, but it tastes juicy and delicious, and the signals are being sent to the brain, so I guess that's what matters to me. So yeah, I don't know how to answer that really, but what I do think is that you can influence the way that your life turns out, I guess. I mean, maybe that's also a myth. I mean, I'm not giving great answers here. I don't really know.
It's okay. They're impossible questions, but I've also found that the belief that I can change and that I have control has helped create better outcomes. But then you start thinking, well, is that belief just programmed?
Is that belief exactly right?
So but
here's the thing, like, if you don't believe that, let's say you don't know the nature of reality and how we came to be and if things are programmed or not, it's still a more helpful belief to believe the lie that you could control it, right? So that's kind of where I'm at, I guess.
Yeah, on the same idea or topic of a mind virus, you spoke in a previous podcast about how it seemed like in 2020 gardening became a mind virus, and it became something that infected more and more people. And I just thought that was a fascinating concept and idea, because we often don't think about the things that we think about as viruses. And it could be a virus in a positive sense, but when you say virus, it sounds negative. But it's an interesting concept. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
When COVID happened, and I think it was January 28th, that I was talking to my girlfriend and I was looking at the math, like virology math, and I was like, oh shoot, if this has the sort of the constants of the constant properties of the virus that I think it has, it could be really bad, right? You know, the R-naught and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, whatever, I won't discuss how that sort of played out, but it made me think about word of mouth and how Epic has grown, as well as how other projects grow. And really, if you think about it, word of mouth is one of the only truly sort of free types of marketing that exist. And all the best companies or movements that have ever happened, that's the fundamental growth driver. And if you think about word of mouth, that's actually just words coming out of one mouth and going into another, much like a bacteria would or a virus. So it is actually, you can look at word of mouth through sort of virology math. And so that's, to me, that's always underpinned how I've thought about, you know, building Epic or other things, is really all these, you know, paid acquisition, all these other forms of marketing, fantastic and supplemental. But if you can't crack the nut of someone watching your video or consuming your content and then telling 1.x people, then you're sort of dead in the water.
Why do we share the things we share?
Well, that's a good, yeah. I mean, someone might say that you share it to reinforce what you think, right? If there's a hot take that you agree with and you retweet it and you're like, I also agree in this hot take. That's certainly one way. I think, you know, you share out of love and care for your friends and family. If I see a piece of content I think would help my cousin, you know, I'll shoot it over to him and say, dude, you need to check this out. Like, this is exactly what we were talking about. And then I think a lot of sharing is emotional sharing, right? Something that makes you feel sad, makes you feel happy, that's hilarious. I mean, the rise of all these different, like, little TikTok meme accounts that are going around is proof of that. That's a mix of a lot of things.
It would be cool to look at the last 100 things, like have it on a spreadsheet, have the last 100 pieces of content that you personally shared, texted, or sent to somebody you know or like, and be like, why did I do that?
That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, I've never thought.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, because this is a content creator dilemma. As you get in your own, you're doing a one-to-many, right? I'm publishing out on YouTube. We'll have a video that comes out later today. And I'll be thinking about it only sometimes from the lens of Kevin publishing, but not Kevin consuming or what other things I might watch. So that's a clever exercise of what am I sharing? And what's my internal motivation? Because it gives you an inside look into the psychology of sharing in general.
Yeah. On the topic of content creation, you had this great tweet that was like, content creation is a language. Platforms are dialects. You can't rock to a bar in Boston and expect to be seen as a local if you're speaking like a Cali surf bro. I thought that was so brilliant. It stayed with me. And I was like, that is really true. So my question to you is, like, how do you go about dissecting a bar or a new platform?
I guess I could talk about TikTok, because that's the one that's the most recent. And so I got on TikTok for Epic Gardening in 2019, I think in August. And back then it was really just less mature and more juvenile. That there wasn't an established sort of meme structure or like 100 different trends running at any point in time. And so a lot of the times back then I was like, okay, well, what's the format? The base language is the format. Vertical video, generally, I think at that time they had gated it to 15 seconds. So I'm like, okay, this is basically an IG story. And that's not the case, because the container and the app itself forces the format, in the sense of you're filming the TikTok video in TikTok, at least back then, and you can cut and arrange the clips. It's not like an IG story, because an IG story is one continuous click, right? And you could append text. There was just extra functionality. And so I was like, okay, well, how is everyone using this functionality? And just kind of went on from there and kept on trying stuff. But yeah, I think it's all coming from the base of making things people value, right? And that's what I kind of meant by content creation as a language. There's people who struggle with it. And it's for one of an infinite number of variables, but it kind of all boils down to, you did not make something valuable enough to perform the way that you wanted it to perform.
Yeah. And so when you think about breaking it down and actually, when did you realize that it actually was working? What you went on the platform in August of 2019, when we were like, oh, this is something, this is working.
I think October probably. Because at the beginning, it was cringe. It was probably still on the TikTok account where I was following the trends, right? And I realized, actually, the real trend here is the format itself of vertical video that can be sort of clipped. It's not that, you know, I picked this audio and lip-synced the exact thing that the audio is saying, and then a plant's in the background, right? That's not going to add the value. And so I was like, actually, I'll just make even shorter versions of the type of content I was making in the first place. So like plant facts, educational things, how to's, you know, did you know this? This is how you grow a radish, all this sort of stuff. There was a piece of content that did really well back then that made me realize the power of the platform and the scale of the platform, that I was like, okay, this is for sure going to take the world over in October 2019, because there's a plant called a dragon fruit that has a flower that will literally open and close in a day, which is just rare in the plant world. Like, not many things happen that fast in gardening. And so in October of 2019, there was a flower, my very first dragon fruit flower. And so it was like 4 p.m. I filmed a quick TikTok and I was like, guys, this is crazy. I can't believe it. It's taken me 18 months to get to this point. This is going to open tonight. But it's like, stay tuned, because in like 2 hours, it's going to open. And that was the TikTok. And it was like a four-parter, I think. Back then, a lot of people were doing stay tuned, part one, part two, part three, part four to get the follow. But this was a true part one, part two, part three. There was no, I couldn't speed it up, right? I wasn't just like backlogging the content to get you to follow. And so that was it. I mean, in a week, I think we gained 350,000 followers. And I was like, okay, I've never seen something rip this hard. Even on YouTube, even back on the early days of Instagram, nothing's ripped this hard. And the people are different. It's it's a younger demographic. And so I was like, oh my God, like this is for sure going to take the world over. And lo and behold, now Instagram is mostly reels. YouTube is over-indexing on shorts, right? Everyone's doing this now.
How do you gain all of that attention and awareness, but not yourself get lost in that process?
In the sense of like thinking you're cool because you're getting all the attention,
not,
or?
Not quite. In the sense of like, well, you realize that your success is based on the ability for you to understand the community, the algorithm of that platform. So how do you know when the right amount of time to consume on that platform is? For example, when I went on TikTok and started to go into it, I was consuming a lot of TikTok as well. And because I was consuming so much, I noticed that like the way I was thinking was different and I didn't like it. And I pulled back because of that and stopped consuming on the platform, which then made the content on that I was posting on that platform worse. So
do worse, yeah.
So how do you think about that as somebody who's successfully gone through it?
I think I could certainly pull back a little bit on my consumption habits. There's no surprise there. But part of it is like, I guess it goes back to the whole value piece. If the thing you're putting out is valuable, it doesn't matter that much if you're not aping a trend. Thus, you don't necessarily need to, you know, consume a ton of the platform to play the game. Now, I think consuming none is probably a mistake. There's like little nuances and intricacies you pick up, but that's sort of a personal choice. I would say if I was early in the game and I wanted to sort of redo what we've done, it is mostly all I would do. I wouldn't spend much time on anything else because you need to go full native. Like you need to immerse yourself in it and really bathe in the memes and the trends, and whether it's YouTube or TikTok or whatever else. Now, I've done it for so long that I can see something very quickly and say, oh, I know exactly why that's hitting and how I might adapt that to what I'm doing. I don't need to go as deep. But yeah, I mean, certainly if you're early on, you're going to gain incredible value from doing that.
And if you were starting Epic Gardening today, where would you spend your most time in terms of creation?
I think this answer is aging slightly. Like the half-life of this answer is aging. But I would go still with TikTok. So I'd create natively on TikTok on an iPhone because the app functions better on an iPhone, even though I'm an Android guy. I have an iPhone specifically for that. So I would go TikTok native on an iPhone. I would not post-produce anything. I'd just edit it in the app. And I would post there. I would see what over-indexed. I'd see what helped me grow. And then I would start an Instagram and a YouTube and a Facebook page. And I would just repost the top 20-ish percent of the things that worked on TikTok to those accounts so that those started to go as well. So now I'd have four platforms that are all short-form platforms, at least the way I'm playing them. But three of those platforms can go long-form or can go video or can go, you know, carousel posts or whatever. And so from there, I'd start practicing, okay, well, maybe I'll do like, you know, a horizontally shot 3-minute video for YouTube. That's like a tiny little step up, you know, into the world of production. Cause all guys like me who are sort of older YouTubers, we all came from horizontal. And so most of us, I think I'm an exception here cause I got pretty good, I think at short form, but most of us are like, yo, what is this? And we have to adapt downwards. But now all the young kids that are coming up from TikTok have no clue how to shoot a long form video. And literally, to be honest, I went to VidCon, dude, And I saw some TikTokers up on stage, like 12 million followers, etc. Nothing against them, but they literally could not talk in more than 30-second chunks of time. Like their brain, it's like their brains didn't work, which was mind-boggling to me.
Well, that's what I started to notice happen to myself when I consumed a lot on the platform, and it scared me because I was like, mm-hmm. I want to have thoughtful, deep conversations, and this is hurting my ability to do that. So
yeah, and then you pick up all the stupid slang, like. I've picked up so many stupid like phrases. Well, they're not even stupid. I mean, if I was 20, I'd be using them all the time. They're not stupid, but you get what I mean.
Yeah, well, you even said the word cringe earlier, which I'm like, is that from TikTok? Is that from... And it's hard to figure out like how much of ourselves is the platforms we consume, how much of it is based on the culture, how much of ourselves is based on our own looking at ourselves and self-awareness. Like, it's so confusing for me. And
it goes back to what we were saying, though, dude, about the fact that maybe there isn't, maybe there is no consistent self, and maybe this month your dialect is 20% more influenced from TikTok than it was the prior month, and if you stopped it, it won't be. And instead of like, I don't know, making some sort of judgment against it, just sort of watching it and being like, yeah, I guess I'd rather not say slay 24/7. You know, I don't
know. Yeah, I guess where I struggle is I judge myself for it because I don't know if that's a good judgment or a bad judgment, but I guess time will tell.
I suppose the act of making, so you judge yourself negatively, let's say, for maybe your ability to slowly stop having a deeper conversation because you're watching TikTok, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess like the act of the judging might be the good or bad thing. Less the judgment itself, right? So if you didn't judge it and just said, oh, I looks like I'm watching more TikTok lately and it's affecting me, I think I'll shift it, but you didn't say it's bad that I did that, to me it feels like there's more grace in that.
Yeah, I'm trying for to operate under those conditions, so
yeah
I appreciate you pointing that out. On the topic of learning and learning new things, You've said before, ever since I've been a teenager, I've been obsessed with learning things, getting better at things, and striving for something higher than myself. But what is that something? I didn't and don't know. I just knew it had to be something. That's from a Medium blog post on July 29th, 2015. Do those words
long time ago.
Still ring true?
I think to a degree, yeah. The higher than myself is an interesting phrase. I wouldn't have expected myself to use that. But I think there is, to me, there is this level of like constant exploration, constant curiosity. And it does to me feel like if you're not getting better, however you define it, it doesn't have to be some linear, you know, I'm lifting more weights or whatever. Maybe I'm becoming a better communicator or more caring person. It does to me feel like that is sort of the point of life. Because, you know, a rock doesn't get better or worse. It just sort of is there and the environment impacts it. Whereas us or other living things, we're sort of these like local entropy reversing machines where for the time that we're alive in the sphere around us, we're sort of breaking the laws of the universe or what the universe eventually will do, right? Like second law of thermodynamics, entropy, eventually everything will be cold and dead and very far apart. But for now, we're not. And so I'm like, okay, well, you might as well strive against it while you're in this state. So I guess that's my perspective. These answers, they're so hard for me. I don't have anything. I don't have any like great logic behind this stuff.
I think it's important to
to
ask ourselves, like, in what ways are we growing? And I think that's it's been the most important thing that's happened in my life is growth in different areas. And it sounds like the same for you as well.
Totally. And then I guess like learning when to stop growing in a certain area because you grew too, you've grown enough there and you're like stunted somewhere else and you're trying to maximize the 1% of the thing that you already have an abundance of, right?
Yeah. And that's why I pointed out the self-awareness of you, because you were talking to, I'm not sure which podcast it was on, but you're saying how, you know, some part of you admires the CEOs and the people in the world of technology, but you also realize that you don't want to play that game. And it is something beautiful where you can admire someone or something, but realize that it's not right for you. That to me denotes a strong sense of self-awareness.
Yeah, I think back in the days where I was so proud of my mediocre businesses in my early 20s, I would have idolized those types of folks much more than I do today. But if you look at, I don't know, an Elon Musk type of guy, really, would you trade the lifestyle though? I think most people wouldn't. I mean, he's an outlier among outliers, right? It's hard to even imagine what being in his brain might be like. And certainly for him, it's the exact right choice, it seems. But for no one else, it would be. And I think recognizing that is probably the important thing. I've thought many times I should take a sabbatical and become a short order cook because it just seems very pleasing to like be in the kitchen and like make amazing diner food for like 3 months. I don't know. It just seems fun. So it's like realizing those things about yourself is important, I think.
Why don't you do that?
I think there will be a time when I probably do. Or intern at a restaurant or something like that. It might not be the short order cook thing. And maybe I will find a way in which I can bake it into the world that we're building, you know, with Epic, because certainly food and gardening go well together. Right now, it's so fun to do the thing I'm doing now that I think I'd rather do this than be a short order cook, but it's still attractive.
How do you figure out when the right time to stop playing a game is?
I think when you... this is actually a really tough question, because you would have to have the presence of mind to step away and see yourself from the outside and say like, wow, this dude over here is like really striving for another $1 million when he has 7, but he only spends 100K a year. So why is he doing that? You'd have to be able to see that about yourself, which most people probably either couldn't or wouldn't want to admit. Right. But to me, that is how I think about it. Like unless you are obsessive, and those people exist, like Kobe would be a good example. Like, it's basketball first and everything else second to 10th. Even though he was a pretty, you know, talented guy across many disciplines, it was still basketball first, right? Mm. And he's like, if I live my whole life and that's the thing I'm the greatest at, that's fine. Whereas myself, at least, I'd rather taste more different disciplines. I don't need to become, you know, elite at one and that's the only thing I'm known for or I know myself for.
Yeah, you've said before you're trying to optimize for uniqueness and life experience. When did you realize that?
Pretty early, I would say. Yeah. You know, even as a kid, like just the different hobbies that I got into, from collecting rocks to drawing to like polishing gems and coins, all sorts of weird stuff. I was like, I think I'm into like everything to some degree. So yeah, I just nothing. Gardening certainly. Poker hooked me for quite some time. There's been like certain passions that I've gone deeper on. Gardening is one that's like an underpinning of my life now. I couldn't imagine never doing it, but it's also not like the most active hobby of all time. It's more of a set it up, maintain it, not like, it's not like playing basketball, you know.
Why do you admire Tiger Woods?
Tiger Woods is interesting because he had it all, right? And he was one of the most celebrated athletes of all time. He lost it. In a way, you could say, both his physicality, his injuries, obviously some of the personal things that he's gone through and the public sort of nature of that, and then his struggles afterwards have been pretty well publicized, and he's not the athlete he once was. And then you still see his mind, though, doesn't seem to have been affected much by this, at least outwards. You can't know a guy's internal life, but you can see the mentality. It's the clarity of his belief that seems so interesting to me. I saw some TikTok edit that it was a ice cold quote. Someone's like, do you think you're going to win 18? He's like, to be honest, no, I've accepted I'm going to win more. Just stone cold, you know? And if he was like elevated in that moment, he might say like, well, the probability is actually pretty low, but it doesn't matter because he just doesn't think that. And there's something about that you just have to admire.
In what ways do you apply that to your own life, or you don't?
I don't think I actually have much of that, to be honest. Like the thing I wish I had was more of like killer instinct type of vibe. I certainly have it in certain areas of life, but something that I've always struggled with is like getting and staying in incredible shape, right? Because the way I've approached business is through finding high leverage ways to use my time that scale out even though I'm not working. at least actively working. Like, you know, during the pandemic, I filmed a video on growing ginger in containers. It took me an hour to film and it's got 10 million views. So the leverage on time is insane with the work that you do as a creator. And at least for me, I find that type of work so attractive that, like, when it comes time to push weight in the gym and eat well over 3 months, it's very difficult for me to, like, keep that going. So that's something I wish I had more of.
The killer instinct piece is so interesting because do you think that's something you're born with or you're not?
You know, I wonder, man. I think certainly some of it probably is that way. Like Jordan, Michael Jordan, was he that way when he was 5? I wish I knew. But certainly he became that way, and then it seems like he, as he's aged, has sort of resented the fact that he is that competitive.
Hmm.
And he wishes he could pull off, but it's simply, he feels, at least I've seen a couple quotes where he's like, it's just how I am. Like, I hate it sometimes, but I can't ever turn it off. And some people just seem to be that way. I'm not that way.
Well, it's funny because I was talking to Charlie from Charisma on Command, who I know you have some sort of relationship or connection with, and yeah, he was talking about how the things that got you to where you're at are going to be the things that you have to unlearn at another point in your life. And I mm-hmm. just thought that was so fascinating because if you look at it in the context of Michael Jordan, the thing that got him to be the greatest basketball player of all time are now the things that he resents, in your words. So it's like, in your life, what do you think the things are that got you to this place that you now have to unlearn or have unlearned in the past?
Well, take the whole pursuit of health and fitness, mm-hmm. right? The things that grew epic was understanding, like, how to create content, how to build systems, train teams, and, you know, really leverage time and energy. Whereas with fitness and diet, it's like you just have to do it every day without fail, and there's no substitute. There's no real hack to do it. Yeah, there's, like, I don't know, you can listen to Huberman and do some Tongkat Ali or whatever, but it's like, it doesn't matter if you're still slamming burritos, right? Yes. So to me, I have a friend who works in the Border Patrol and Horse Patrol, like tackling smugglers and stuff.
Wow.
And I have another friend who's in NCIS and does, like, crime scene. So these are, like, sort of hardened guys, right? Athletes, grew up playing college sports, not like me. And they've always joked, they're like, you need to develop, like, the suffer gene. You just don't have the suffer gene. Whereas my friend, he can just, like, mountain bike up a hill, dying the entire time. And he's like, yeah, like, dude, this is awesome, you know? And I'm like, can I just go downhill and hit a coffee shop? You know, so it's like, I don't know how I'm supposed to develop that part of my brain except by repetition and, like, slowly getting there, you know?
Yeah, well, it's funny because a lot of people would look at posting themselves online or writing articles as suffering in some respect, but you somehow,
yeah, not to me, I guess.
You've somehow found a way to make that happen.
I think I just inherently enjoy the act of making content. Mm. So to me, there's no willpower involved. It's not hard really at all. Like, even to this day, yeah, we have, like, long shoot days, or, you know, we'll pack a lot of weird things. We'll have to re-edit something or reshoot something, and that's kind of annoying. But it doesn't feel like it takes much mental energy or certainly any suffering from my point of view. Whereas, you know, then I go to my personal trainer and try to slam something out, and I'm like, oh my God, dude, like, if you weren't here, I'd be quitting right now, which I hate. I don't like that about myself. I wish I could change.
How much of life should we focus on suffering, and how much of life should we focus on things that come easy and are natural to us?
To me, I feel like if you want the surest path to whatever you want to call success is if you max out the things that come naturally to you, you will cruise your way through things that other people will completely struggle to do. Like, if I had tried to be a CrossFit athlete, you know, I wouldn't be talking to you. I wouldn't be talking to anyone. Like, no one would want to talk to me, you know, I'd just be struggling doing some random thing right now. And so, you know, it's just, that would have been a much harder path for me than the one I did now. And I have friends who are athletes that was very easy. And then they want to build a business coaching, and they want to talk about, you know, making a YouTube channel or something. And every single thing I say, I can see their eyes go totally blank. And they're just like, no, dude, I'm not doing this. So yeah, I don't know. It's a good question.
Well, it's interesting too, because it's like, the way I phrase the question implies that it's either struggle or it's easy. But the truth is that even if you're doing something that's easy, there are going to be parts of it that are struggling. Like, it's like, you could easily say after 3 hours of filming, you know, I'm going to do 3 hours because that was easy. But then, like, the fourth hour, I'm done with that. So mm-hmm. I think that even in the things that come easy, you are going to struggle through some parts of them as well.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, for me, let's take filming and making video content specifically, especially this type of stuff we make now. Now, like back in the day, you could go all the way back on our YouTube channel. There's videos from the early, early days where it's just a phone on a couch. I didn't even turn notifications off. So I'm getting texts throughout while filming. It's like terrible, dude. And, you know, that's easy. I didn't even cut the clip. I just cut the intro and outro when I picked the phone back up to turn the recording off. That's a very easy video to film. And I guess they've done well, mostly because there was nothing else out there at the time. But, you know, these days we're thinking about, okay, we want to do a video on growing corn. We want to do it full seed to harvest. So it's going to take at least 100 days to film it. But when you release it, everyone will be done with growing corn. So you actually have to release it the year after or grow it in a time where you could release it at the start of the season. So there's like clips to organize. There's different edits. There's all sorts of different files and stuff. And so I've just slowly started to hire and delegate for the things that I certainly am not going to be good at, like the media management of all of that stuff. That would have been extremely draining to me at our stage now. Back in the day, it was one clip. Now it's like, you know, 40 or something. So yeah, you kind of have to parcel it all out and build a team around yourself, in my opinion.
How do you go about doing that effectively?
So what I did back in the day is, I think it was 2018, I hired my first editor because I just realized, again, like, why didn't I realize this sooner? But I was like, I'll never be the best editor. So why would I ever edit my videos? It just makes no sense. Now, a lot of YouTubers don't think that's true. I know a lot of big YouTubers that still edit everything. I think someone like Johnny Harris probably still edits all his stuff, or at least has a heavy hand in it. My world's not that complicated. It's gardening. It's not, you know, explainer videos. And so I was like, I'll just hire an editor, see how it goes. If only he replicated exactly what I was doing and didn't even improve it, it would have been worth it, right? So yeah, I mean, I found an editor off of Upwork, the one that we use now. We actually have a whole team in the Philippines with an office, and the original guy who edits for us, he just DM'd me on Instagram. And so I'm half Filipino, so it's awesome working with a Filipino team. And yeah, I mean, it's crazy the things they can do that I just, good luck having me do like a motion blur and like a speed ramp edit. Like, I, you know, I'm just not going to be the one to do that.
It's so cool when the people who love your content the most are the ones who reach out and end up working on it. It feels like there's an extra layer of love that people will mm-hmm. instill in it. And I think that is a good sign that you're on the right path as a creator. It's like, if people are coming to you and wanting to help with your mission in some respect.
I think so. And I don't know, you know, do you have editors for what you're up to?
So recently, a few different people who have loved the podcast edit clips and now are editing these. Shout out Pablo. Pablo is crushing it.
Hey, Pablo.
With just the thing is, like, he's editing it way better than I could. And I'm just like, oh my God, why didn't I do this sooner? So
totally, man. I think the thing too is, like, if we're getting into the nitty gritty of the editing world, the longer someone edits for you, the more knowledge you both have on how to dance between the creation and the post-production of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a video that I'm filming with our, you know, videographer, I have little signals or notes or little winks that I'll pass to the editing team in the actual filming of the video. So I might take a pause and I might say, like, actually, you know, I want to see like a media, like a news report, 5-second cut here. You know, and so you'll pass little winks and nods, but then also they just know all of your content. To me, that's extremely valuable because I might be talking about, I don't know, growing cabbage. And, you know, my team knows that I tried to grow cabbage last year. It failed. And my first big success was cabbage. And they'll edit from 3 years worth of videos into one video. You can't know that unless who else would know that? It's only you, the creator, or someone who's done all that work.
What do you think most creators get wrong when they're in their first 3 years of building their brand online?
I would say, you know, that's interesting. It really is sort of a bespoke question based on maybe the platform or what they're trying to do. But I would say thinking that they actually are the one that needs to do every part of the process. Certainly these days, I don't think that's that hot of a take. Most people are used to that now, but you know, back when I was doing YouTube at the start, like it would be very weird if you said you had an editor. It'd be odd. You'd be like, huh? Or like when, you know, when I was blogging back in the day, I wrote the first 400 articles for our blog. And then I said, maybe I should hire some help for the blog, because maybe I can't just write forever, right? And so I hired a very experienced, you know, horticulturist and researcher who has written and managed the writing of a lot of stuff from then on out. And yeah, I sort of editorially direct some of that now, but not much. And I've, you know, moved on to the thing that, that I think I'm the most valuable at. So I think a lot of creators just are one man or one woman showing it for way too long.
I love that. Yeah, that's a great take. You, speaking about hot takes, you've said before, most of what we've developed technologically doesn't materially improve our lives in the same way as walking with a friend in a forest eating good food would. I love that. So true.
When did I say that one?
Who knows?
Somewhere in the abyss of the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I think if you... do we have, you know, plug-in ports in our bodies? We don't, right? We haven't evolved that. And so it doesn't make... To me, it doesn't make sense that the last 100-ish years, 150 years worth of progress perfectly maps to an increase in happiness. Now, there's probably like some researchers who disagree with me there, but I don't know. There's all sorts of diseases that simply couldn't really have existed in the past. These diseases of abundance, that there's all sorts of mental issues that are coming up. There's like, I don't know, dozens of different sort of things in the DSM that I sort of think technically, yeah, you could call that a disease, but also in the absence of modern society may never really show up in the human population, right? And so to me, it's like I always think of it as like high tech natural. You should do like a Talebian barbell strategy, right? Of the best things of society. Like I can talk to you on this podcast because of tech. That's amazing. But after this, if I'm feeling a little frazzled or whatever, I should probably just like go in the sun and have like some tea and like pick a tomato, because that's probably going to make me happier, right? So that's how I think about it.
Yeah, you've said before that you started getting into gardening because you wanted to, as a way to take out the screens from your life. But as a result, you've started using more screens. But you found a way to merge it too quite well, I feel like.
Yeah, I think the funny irony of the whole thing is that, yeah, I started it because I was addicted to video games after college playing poker and started gardening to get off the computer, and then immediately built a blog, built a YouTube channel, built a podcast, right? All these digital entities, which for the first few years, you really are behind the computer. Like I was writing for 12 hours a day for at least a year, which is on the computer, right? So it took a long time.
What are you most proud of from the whole operation?
I think the messages that you get that show the impact in a way that makes it really visceral. I got a message even just today from a woman who I think might be one of the oldest sort of followers. She said she's been watching us since she was 15 and she's 24.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, if that's the case, then you actually watched one of the first videos we ever did, because that was like 9-ish years ago. And that was like 3 years before I even went on this thing full time. And so, you know, her life now looks different as a result of consuming the content. She has chickens, she has an orchard, she has all this stuff that, yeah, maybe she would have gotten there eventually, but the fact that she got there through us does mean something, right? So to me, that's the impact. It kind of goes back to the thing about playing the different game, where the money and the sort of financial success, et cetera, it's like, okay, there's a point where that starts to become just what it is. You're like, okay, cool. Like money is good. And then these sorts of things, you never really get old, never really get sick of.
I loved how you broke down why you stopped playing poker, which is basically like, if I'm going to make a little bit more money and I'm going to take from this person who's a slightly worse player, it's very zero sum and it's not helping the world in any meaningful way. But if I teach somebody how to garden, if I teach somebody how to communicate better, that is, or if I help someone build their business, which I see you do, trying to do on your new YouTube channel, linked below, it is, it is like, that is such a more powerful impact you can have. So
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think the poker thing was interesting because you're right. Poker's actually negative sum because you're playing against other players. But the house takes a rake. So actually it's negative sum. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a game, and the game usually means you're taking advantage of lower skilled players, which is the game they're playing. It's not like I think that's bad. That's just what it is. But I also looked forward at, like, guys at the time I was 22, I think, when I quit, and the guys who were 26, 27 that I knew, I was like, dude, I don't want to live this way. They're just like, it's just like extended college, and they make a lawyer's salary. Because it's really an hourly job. You can break your earnings down into a per hour. It's not like you're earning when you turn the computer off, right? So it is a true hourly job. It's just a high-paying job. And I was like, yeah, there isn't an escape from this path if I don't get off now.
I think it's such a useful and impactful practice of just looking at somebody who's 2 years ahead of you on doing whatever you're doing and be like, do I want to be that? Is that somebody who is something that I'd like to be? Whenever I've done that in the world, that's resulted in me changing actions and helped me to navigate to a future that's a little bit brighter.
Did you have a path that you like thought you were going to go down and you did that exercise and you're like, actually, I don't want to be this person?
Yeah. I was in the e-commerce dropshipping world right out of college, very similar to you in the same mindset. I'm not working for anyone. This is like, I can make it on my own. I can figure it out. And I was super proud of myself for doing that. And then I was like, well, if I play this out a couple of years, like I'm not building a brand. I'm not building something that's exciting to me. I wouldn't have done this as a child. Like, what am I doing here? And so I was like, I was in San Diego at the time and I was like, let me be a personal trainer. And so that was the first thing that I said that like, let me actually make an impact on the world.
The thing that gets me is that whole world of young male entrepreneurship, I guess you could call it. Because I feel like it wasn't that developed when I was in my early 20s. Maybe I was too caught up in the poker thing. But what I notice is it's this relentless thinking of like, I need to like be a baller right away. Like,
yes.
I need to scale my e-com business, selling a thing I don't give any care for to $1 million so I can get another thing that I don't really think I'll use. It's this whole like, if you go down to the root cause of it, you're like, there is nothing there. There's no like true driver there. And to me, at least, even if Epic was a tenth of the level of success that it is today, I still would have chosen it over something 10x more successful than that, right? So to me, it's a bigger win.
Yeah, and on that piece too, it's like the revenue. You know it because people are putting revenue on a pedestal of like,
I'm making
this amount of revenue. And like, what it was for me at least, I won't speak for anyone else, is like, I want to be seen as valuable by you. And I'm using this increased number as a way to do that. And realizing that was so impactful and made me like lose my mind for a little bit. Because I'm like,
I'm sure it kind of tore you apart, right?
Yeah,
I'm doing this
for 2 years. And this is not something that I actually enjoy and that I believe is making the world a better place. I'm just doing it for my own ego and my own sense of importance. And look, like I start yoga and meditation and reading Eckhart Tolle, and that all happens at the same time. And I'm like, I can't do that. I can't do this path anymore.
Okay, so it sounds like you sort of had a similar realization at some point in time, right?
Yes.
It's a gift to get it that young, though, don't you think? I mean, I know people that are older than me that have no sense of this in their life whatsoever. People that I know really well. That consideration does not exist in their brain, which is very bizarre. And even if you bring it up, they're like, well, that's not... it's like they didn't hear it. You know? Bizarre.
Well, I think it's important to ask yourselves, in what way... And I constantly try to do this. In what way is what I'm currently doing wrong, or am I taking the wrong action? And I think you can get into a trap of thinking that you're always down the wrong path or whatever, but I think it's just worth asking yourself, I'm doing things that 10 years from now, the person that I am is not going to think highly of potentially. And so what are some of those things? And it's a helpful exercise.
I think, I mean, in business, you would hope you would cringe at something 6 months ago, because progress-wise, I mean, I look back, last year was you know, we raised some capital in the end of 21, and 22 was like the scale-up year. We bought an entire seed company and are folding that in. So it's certainly some like incredible moves. But I look back at some of my decisions as CEO founder, and I'm like, how could I have thought that was the right strategic move? Like, that doesn't even make sense to me. It's almost like another person had the thought, which I think in business, probably good, as long as you're not repeating those. In life, it's interesting because, you know, maybe maybe you have to go through Danny dropship phase, right? Because you can only then ping off of that to know what a more true feeling path would be. And, you know, in 6 years time, you're absolutely crushing it. And you're like, yeah, like I'm very thankful I was sort of clowning around dropshipping for a while. Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm thankful I did all the dumb things I did because I wouldn't be here.
I think that life, what I've realized is just a way to get to know yourself better. Like, And the reason why the people who are the oldest are typically the most skillful livers is because they know themselves the best and therefore know what the right path for them to do is. So
I think about it. There's the whole, you know, in the world of like, I don't know, seduction or relationships, there's the whole meme of like, everyone just says, oh, just be yourself. Like, that's all we really want. It's just, you know, we want a guy to be himself, a girl to be herself. And then, you know, the guy or girl who's struggling with that is like, what do you mean? Like, I'm myself all the time and you don't seem to like that, so I need to change myself. And then you go down this path of like, I need to be someone else. And to me, I certainly have can identify with that, especially when I was younger. But what I guess I realized is it's better. It's not that people want you to be more yourself. It's more that they want you to not be anything that isn't you. Mm. And it's easier to know what's not you than to know what you are. So if you go out to a party or something and someone offers you a drink you don't like and you take the drink, like, I don't know, you don't like a Negroni and you take the Negroni, instead of saying, yeah, I appreciate it. I actually don't really like Negronis though, so I'll pass, but maybe I'll go get like, you know, a martini. You've now done something that is, you've rejected what isn't you. It's a small thing, but to me that's the more important way to think about it.
1,000%. And this actually happened yesterday where how I eat a burger is just the burger and the bun. No lettuce, tomato, just plain.
Nothing in it. Okay. Yeah.
And I was talking to the waitress and the waitress was saying, I eat it the same way, but I get so embarrassed about that. And I'm like, why? That's just what your preference is. And you tried it a different way and look, this is normal. And like, her ability, and she said to me, sometimes I'll get something on it just to not be made fun of in that situation. And and I said that the importance of being yourself, actually doing what your own values and what you actually like and owning that is like what I believe is like the most important piece of life, because that extrapolate, she was telling me a situation where it, like, she left somebody because of understanding what was more true to herself. It's like that one situation about the burger can be extrapolated so far in the big decisions in our lives that it's like you owning yourself is actually what the game is all about.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It sounds so stupid to say that because you ordered pickles and you don't like them so that someone doesn't make fun of you might potentially have an impact on major decisions in your life. A lot of people would not agree with that. But I do. I think it's kind of like the how you do anything is how you do everything thing. But in a more nuanced or little esoteric way, I suppose. But I think about that a lot. Like, what was I doing? I was eating a food. I was eating a food in a weird way. I eat food in weird ways. I try to find it. It was the croissant. Yeah, the croissant. And so I'm sitting there eating the croissant and it gets crumbs like all over the table if you do it this way, because you're like deconstructing the croissant and then you're just eating the core of it. It's so weird. So I'll sit there at the coffee shop and I'll get my cappuccino and croissant and I'll literally put crumbs all over the table and look like an absolute slop. And then I just push the croissant crumbs into the little container that it came in, and the problem is now solved. So I did that though with my girlfriend. We went and got coffee and croissants and I did that. And she's like, what are you doing? Like, this is, you're not concerned that you're just looking like a child? And I'm like, well, in 5 minutes, there'll be no crumbs and none of them will be on the floor either. So what's the difference between then and now? Now, I think there is like a level with which you can take this too far, where you are being more than yourself just to be different, you know, which you certainly don't want to be down that path where you're like the most eclectic person ever, you know, but I don't know. There's certain things you kind of have to hold firm on.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. And I think like the more experiences we have, the better we can actually understand ourselves at a deeper level, which goes back to the people being older leading to a better understanding of self. I like to end these podcasts with a challenge, because I think you listen to the podcast, you consume it, but what action should somebody listening take from everything we've spoke about or something we haven't yet covered?
Let's keep going with the theme we were just talking about and say, I would challenge anyone listening. There's got to be one thing that happens nearly daily for you that you do, even though you know it's not what you feel like doing. And I'm not saying like the project your boss gave you. I'm just saying something small enough, like the pickle on the burger or some weird little quirky thing about you. I would say commit that one thing you will not sacrifice on ever again. Just if you want, you know, to drink your water in some stupid way that everyone's like, what the hell is this guy doing? Just do that and just say, just don't even address it. It's just how you drink water. It's not a big deal. If that's it, right? I would say do that, because you would be surprised at what it kind of opens up in your mind.
That's such a beautiful challenge. I love it. And where can we send people to connect with you further?
Well, so I'm on Twitter, which is how we connected. That's just my name, Kevin Espiritu. And then everything else really is just Epic Gardening. If you like gardening stuff, even if you don't like gardening stuff, but you like business and sort of analyzing like the way that a creator led business works, it's a good example, I think, to look at.
It definitely is. You've found a way to win at every platform, and there's something that should be studied by everyone. So go check that out. Link below. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Danny. This is super fun.